We're looking now at the second cycle of testing, the interview between God and Satan, and it is all backdropped by the fact that there is always benevolent purpose in the suffering of the believer, even if we can't see it. It is still there. Then we looked at the fact that Satan comes in after having been defeated the first time and says, we'd like to change the rules. In the first test, I was only allowed to take away Job's possessions, and now I would like to be able to test his person. And I believe if I can get to his person, if I can touch him physically, that I can make him curse God. And so we have now in 2, 7 through 9, the disaster that enters into the life of Job. Chapter 2, verse 7. Then Satan went out from the presence of the Lord and smote Job with sore boils from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. And he, Job, took a potsherd to scrape himself. And again, it's a rather grotesque scene. The scraping himself would doubtless be that the boils had pus with them, and he is out there scraping the pus from the wounds while he was sitting among the ashes, and that would locate him basically at the city dump of Ur. And then his wife says to him, do you still hold fast your integrity? Curse God and die. So notice, again, let's say something about the physical suffering of Job and get a little picture of it throughout the book of Job. And we can pick up with probably, seven things that we can say about Job that are described in poetic form to give us this pitiful picture that we've got here. One of the first things is we might classify under the idea of he had some type of dermatitis. Skin inflammation. And that is very clear in chapter 7 and verse 5. I want to pick up some of the details so we'll see the real physical suffering this man is going through. Now again, it is poetic. And being poetic, you have a lot of metaphors and you have figurative speech. But nonetheless, the figurative speech all gets back to some kind of acute dermatitis, first of all. Chapter 7, verse 5, my flesh is clothed with worms and a crust of dirt. And so you've got the worms for the poetic idea of repulsiveness. The crust of dirt would be the scabbing of it. My skin hardens and runs. And so you have a very picture of that type of suffering. He also was unable to sleep. Dermatitis, sleeplessness, is involved in chapter 7 and verse 4. Same passage. When I lie down, I say, when shall I arise? But the night continues, and I am continually tossing until the dawn. Job cannot sleep. He has these running sores that scab and run. And he also was experiencing, in that sleeplessness, when he did sleep, he also experiences nightmares. Horrible picture of suffering. Chapter 7 and verse 14. Well, again, in the context in verse 13, he says, if I say, my bed will comfort me. In other words, I'll go to sleep and forget about the problems. My bed will comfort me. My couch will ease my complaint. Then, if I do go to sleep, what happens? Thou dost frighten me with dreams and terrify me with visions. So, it's a description of what we would call nightmares. Job also suffers from what we would call anorexia. Loss of weight, chapter 19 and verse 20. Anorexia is the affliction for which some of us pray. But it can be very, very serious, and Job apparently is suffering from some form of this, because in chapter 19 and verse 20, he says, my bone clings to my skin and my flesh. And that would come up with our old expression for someone who is just what? Skin and bones. I have my bone clings to my skin and my flesh. I have escaped only by the skin of my teeth. So notice the emphasis on loss of weight or anorexia. He apparently had an enormous problem that must have been with his stomach somehow, because his breath was horrible. 19:17, terminal halitosis. Chapter 19 and verse 17 describes that putrid breath. He says, my breath is offensive to my wife. Horrible thing. Your wife not even be able, every time you talk to your wife, she turns your head. because your breath is horrible. Breath smelling like Brussels sprouts. Terrible thing. My breath is offensive to my wife. I am loathsome to my own brothers. Even young children despise me. I rise up and they speak against me. All my associates abhor me, and those I love have turned against me. And you can imagine again the horrible suffering. And this is from his physical condition, that as he goes down the street, little children scatter in front of Job. Apparently, he has a vision problem. Does not say he was blind, but notice chapter 16 and verse 16. This is just a sampling of some of the horrible physical suffering that Job went through. 16:16. My face is flushed from weeping. And then notice you have in poetic form an expression indicating that he does not see well, because in the last part of verse 16 it says, deep darkness is on my eyelids. So a vision problem. His appearance was shocking. Chapter 2, verse 12. His friends are coming to sympathize with him in the latter part of verse 11 of chapter 2. 2:11 says the three friends heard of all of his adversity and names them, and it says they made an appointment together to come and to sympathize with him and to comfort him. And in verse 12, when they lifted up their eyes at a distance and did not recognize him, they raised their voices and wept, and each of them tore his robe, and they threw dust over their heads toward the sky. And I recognize that a lot of the emotional expression is really hard for us to identify with. I can't imagine someone shaving their head over a catastrophe. But if you go to the Middle East, you will see that kind of emotional type thing. You take a picture in the Middle East of an Arab, and you see the emotional display of, where's my money? Where's my bakshish? And you'll wonder, you mean, is it all that big deal? And it is. There's emotional outburst that is enormous in your Eastern cultures. And this would be not unusual. We are a very, very stoic, reserved people in the West. We don't express emotion in that way, and it probably is not healthy. But nonetheless, you have this expression of emotion in the at the appearance of Job. Now, what we're going to find out is that Job is going to get attacked in every area of his life. He is going to get attacked here physically, but there's more than the physical. In fact, we ought to put these things down. There is the physical aspect of our being, and then there is the soul, and then there is the spirit. And basically, we can understand what physical life is because we have physical life, and so does our dog or cat or whatever pet we may have. However, you've probably observed that your dog or cat does not have very good consciousness of God. Dogs and cats do not pray. Dogs and cats do not even seem to have very good moral standards. We have two cats, and they are brother and sister. And since they are brother and sister, it was not necessary to have them spayed. No, that is not the way with cats. And consequently, you notice an enormous difference is that basically the spirit is our capacity to relate to God, which, of course, an animal does not have. Basically, the soul, while it relates to God, is a little more horizontal in that it relates to people. And, of course, the physical relates to our environment. And Job is going to get tested in every one of these areas. In chapter 2, we've got him being tested in the area of the physical. And we've given a little description of his horrible physical position. Chapter 1, he loses everything material. Then we get down to his person. So we go from the material in chapter 1 to his person in chapter 2, and he gets tested physically. Everything except die, and I think we'll safely put Job that way, is that Job suffers everything except death, and he would rather be dead. Now, we're going to see him in the close of this second chapter be tested in his soul, which is a relationship to people. And where do you think that the soul testing of Job would be the most? What horizontal relationship did he sustain that would be the most difficult for him to withstand? Well, we're going to find that his soul is going to be tested by Mrs. Job, by his wife. Then, by far the bulk of the book, beginning at chapter 3 on through chapter 41, we're going to see the ultimate thing tested, because all of his friends are going to say, you are not in right standing with God. Your spiritual relationship is all out of kelter. So notice we've got the, well, to tabulate them, we've got the material in chapter 1, the physical in chapter 2, the soul at the end of chapter 2, and then all the rest of the book is going to be the most severe testing of all, is you have offended God, and God is against you. And if you can imagine all of your friends coming along and saying, your problem is God is against you, that would be an ultimate test, and this is the one we're going to see Job under. But before we get to the test of his spirit, let's look at the test of soul via his wife. Chapter 2, verse 9. And so this will be the suffering that he receives from his wife. Chapter 2 and verse 9. And I want to simply divide that into two parts. Number one, look at what she proposes. And then second, we'll want to ask, why did she do that? But first of all, what she proposes him to do. Might begin, by the way, in saying that commentators have been really, really hard on Mrs. Job. And I don't think it is totally justified. Granted, when you look at chapter 2, verse 9, she proposed exactly what Satan was trying to get. But nonetheless, I think there can be more explanation to it than that. So look, first of all, at what she proposes. Verse 9, then his wife said to him, do you still hold fast your integrity? Curse God and die. So notice the idea is what Satan wants, she suggests. So we have to say that her suggestion matches that of Satan. Her suggestion is Satan's. Can you think of another lady whose suggestion was also Satan's? Remember Eve? Eve suggested what Satan had suggested to her. So we can't get around the fact that it is true that her suggestion is Satan's. But notice connected with it is curse God and die. And in that could very well be a suggestion of suicide. Suicide from the standpoint that it is taking your life by whatever means apart from God taking that life. And that's very clearly there because it's curse God and die. In other words, getting out of this life is preferable. The interesting thing we'll find is Job in chapter 3 is going to say, I wish I were dead. But he never intimates taking his own life. Never, never, never. And I take it that's going to say that it's God that gave me life, and I cannot take my life, because if God is the giver of life, God is also the one that takes life in his own time. Now, the thing we need to get at, and it's a little bit of speculation, not only what she proposes, but why she proposes it. What she proposes and why. Now, I'll admit, at this point, we're going to have to be speculative. You do get a hint that she is impatient in verse 9. His wife said to him, are you still holding fast your integrity? In other words, she is impatient. And yet, at the same time, she proposes her husband's death or suicide. Now, let's face it. If a wife says to her husband, you'd be better off dead, then you've got one of two things you can come up with. Number one, she detests him. She hates him. She really wants the man dead. Or can you think of another reason why you would wish a person were dead? Have you ever seen someone in enormous suffering and you have said in all sincerity, it would be so good if the Lord would simply take them home. They would be better off in the presence of the Lord, if they're a believer, they would be better off dead. You ever encounter that kind of situation? Is that feasible here? That Mrs. Job is simply saying this, I would rather see my husband dead than to suffer the way I'm seeing him suffer. So you could have it coming out of sympathy for her husband. So let's put possibility. The possibility would be sympathy. I can't stand to see him suffer the way I'm seeing him suffer. That would key off of the fact that she had a strong emotional relationship to her husband, that she loved him, and I would rather see him dead than suffer this way. Is there a lesson coming off of that? If this is true, it's saying this. Notice how Satan can utilize a good emotion for his own purpose. So let's put down as a principle. Satan takes advantage of a worthy emotion for his own purpose. Satan takes advantage of a worthy emotion for his own purpose. Have you ever had a worthy emotion and a worthy motivation and been taken to the cleaners just on the human level? I have since learned, but when we were, before we built here, when the church was down in North Kansas City and I was among the very simple and naive, I don't know how many $5 I handed to guys that were riding the tracks, riding the trains, that would pay it back tomorrow, you know, or had a check that was coming, and they needed food, and I've given many away in that way. Never will I do it again. My motivation was good. I didn't want the man hungry, but I was very stupid, and that emotion was taken advantage of, and of course, needless to say, as of this day, none of them has paid any of the $5 back, but I'm expecting it any day. And this is the same type of thing here. She perhaps is looking at her husband and says, I just cannot bear another day with this man that I love and see him suffer in this particular way. I wish he were dead, and I make the suggestion. That could very well be. If it is the case, then it's very sobering that the very purpose of Satan utilizes her emotional condition or her sympathy for her husband in order to accomplish his own purpose. Keeping your finger here and looking at Genesis 3. Don't you have exactly the same thing? Now, how do you take it, what Eve did in verse 6? Do you take this to be sinister, or do you think she thought she was helping Adam? Verse 6, when the woman saw the tree that was good for food, that it was a delight to the eyes, and that the tree was desirable to make one wise, she took from its fruit and ate, and she gave to her husband. Why do you think she did that? You think she was sinister and she said, I've fallen and I want you to fall. I've sinned and I want you to sin. I take it, that's not even the context, is it? The tree was good for food, and so if it was good for food, what did she want to do? Share it with her husband. It was a delight to the eyes, and she wanted to share it with her husband. It was desirable to make one wise, so she took it, and she passed it on to Adam, which does not alleviate his responsibility, and it does not make her less responsible, but it does say, probably, Satan utilized the fact that she wanted to do for Adam what was good. She utilized a worthy emotion in order to accomplish his own purpose. Now, I am not saying that, though there may be a point here, that perhaps the emotion of sympathy and a desire to do their husband good may be peculiar to a woman. In her desire to please him, she is open to a very, very serious thing that happens in this context. But let's go back to Job. This is the test of his soul. Now, one other comment off of verse 9. Notice that in her mental attitude, she is ready to throw in the towel and curse God. And we might simply make this statement. Which is easier to do? Lower your view of God or raise your faith in God? Which is easier? To lower your view of God or to raise your faith in God? And at this context, rather than raise her faith in God, she's lowered her view of God, which is always the easy way to go. All right, with that now, we have the reaction of Job. The interview, the disaster, and now see the reaction. And it comes in chapter 2, verse 10, verse 10, basically. Now, here's another lesson. Notice that even though she has been the instrument of bringing Satan's desire about, notice the tact that Job has in handling it. He said to her, you speak as a fool. No. You speak as a wicked woman. No. You speak, and what is the next word? Like one of the foolish women speaks. And the idea is that Job is tactful in his approach. The issue is there, not the personality. How do you react if someone says, you are a fool? I do this. I don't like that. I can handle it better if someone says, look, at this point in time, you are talking like a fool. That's different, because that is simply saying that at the moment I may be acting like one, but you're not saying this is my whole pattern. And I take it that perhaps in this verse what he is saying then is that, wife, you're out of character. You usually don't talk this way. Right now you're talking like a foolish woman, and it shows that she is at the moment at least talking out of character. And of course Job gets to the real issue, and then he asserts a principle or a doctrine. Shall we indeed accept good from God and not accept adversity? In all this, Job did not sin with his lips. Why do you think the opening prologue of the book of Job is pounding at a point? Job did not sin with his lips. Well, it's getting us ready for his three friends. And his three friends are going to come along and say, Job, you're not in right relationship to the Lord. So it's going to prepare it for us. And when you get to chapter 3, you might say, boy, it sure doesn't look like Job is right with the Lord here. But he is. And we're assured of that right in the prologue, so we'll have a setting for the rest of the book. So the principle then, or the doctrine that he asserts, is very simple. A giver has a right to be a withholder. If God gives, that's his right. If he withholds, that also is his right. Now, with 11 through 13, we get what we might call the setting for the real test. And the setting for the real test is the test of Job's spirit, or questioning his relationship to God, beginning in verse 11. Now, when Job's three friends heard of all his adversity that had come upon him, they came each one from his own place, Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhite, and Zophar the Naamanite. And they made an appointment together to come to sympathize with him and to comfort him. And what we're going to find is that this test of his relationship to God is going to come through well-meaning friends. Friends that are willing to make a long trip in order to help Job are going to be the very source of his suffering. And notice, as they arrive, they do not recognize him. They respond emotionally. And then in verse 13, you have a very dramatic scene. Then they sat down on the ground with him for 7 days and 7 nights, with no one speaking a word to him, for they saw that his pain was very great. Probably the emphasis here is something we know about statutory law of the time. And by statutory regulation, you mourn for the dead 7 days. And so perhaps here they're looking at Job and they say this, that man is in such bad straits, I can't see any distinction in suffering and mourning for a corpse than I do for Job. And so isn't it appropriate that we sit and we mourn for 7 days for this man? So you might put at the end of verse 13, his friends are looking at Job as though he were a corpse, as though he were a dead man. All right, now we come to the second part, or the heart of the book of Job, leaving the prologue now and coming to the historical dialogue. The historical dialogue, as we've already pointed out, begins in 3:1 and goes through 42:6. And in the dialogue, we will have the lament of Job and then the speech of Eliphaz, and then Job is going to respond to it. And we'll have the speech of Bildad, the speech of Zophar, and then later on the speech of Elihu, and then finally God will respond to it all. But let's begin now with Job's lamentation. It's all of chapter 3. Job's lament. All of chapter 3. And basically, it revolves about three things. And we'll put it in the form of questions. Number one, why was I ever born? Why was I ever born? Job 3, 1 through 10. Why was I ever born? Notice chapter 3, verse 2, just to get the flavor of it. Why was I ever born? Verse 2, and Job said, let the day perish on which I was to be born, and the night which said, a boy is conceived. In other words, in those two verses, he is basically, well, you get the same thing in verse 4, may that day, and that's his birthday, may that day be darkness. let not God above care for it, and let no light shine on it. And that is obviously a lament saying, why was I ever born? Second possibility is, why didn't I die at birth? Why did I not die at birth? First of all, I wish I was never conceived. Now, why didn't I die at birth? And that is in chapter 3, verses 11 through 19. Notice verse 11 summarizes it. Why did I not die at birth, come forth from the womb, and expire? And so the emphasis is, I wish I'd never been conceived. That didn't happen. Why wasn't I a miscarriage? Why wasn't I stillborn, would be the second idea. And third, why can't I die now? Why can't I die now? And that is in verses 20 through 26. Notice verse 20, reading. Why is light given to him who suffers, and life to the bitter of soul, who long for death, but there is none, and dig for it more than for hidden treasures, who rejoice greatly, they exult when they find the grave? I mean, you can't find a lament anymore. My only joy in life right now would be to die. Can you imagine getting in that emotional condition? And by the way, if you've suffered, have you ever gotten that bad? Saying that I can think of only one thing that would make me happy, to die. Is that depression? Is that being low? In all of this, Job did not sin. And it shows the emotional low to which a believer may go and still be in right relationship to the Lord. All right, with his lament now, let's break that down. And first of all, Job is going to curse his birth. Put that down as a B. Job curses his birth. Or why was I born? Or we should say he curses his conception and birth. And that in turn breaks down in these first 10 verses to two parts. He talks about two things. He talks about that day and that night. So, first of all, the curse of that day. Then second, the curse of that night. First of all, the curse of that day. 1 through 5. Verse 1, afterward Job opened his mouth and cursed the day of his birth. Note, he didn't curse God. Note, he didn't curse God. Job never curses God. He curses the day that he was born. And Job said, let the day perish on which I was to be born, and the night which said, a boy is conceived. Notice what he's doing. My present condition is about to cancel my belief in the goodness of God that made me a man. Hello? That you are so wretched, but I don't believe God was good when he made me a person. And therefore, you might say, the goodness of God seems to cancel his belief. I'm sorry, I'm writing that all wrong. His present condition, there we go. His present condition threatens to cancel, and I'm going to leave out that, I'll just put cancels, it didn't really, but for brevity in writing here. His present condition cancels his belief in the goodness of God in making him a man. God would have been better had he not made me. His present condition cancels his belief in the goodness of God in making him a man. It's sort of like Job saying, I am a circle, I am a zero, with the line rubbed out. Okay, remember, his past is lost, his present is miserable, his future is totally empty. Now, notice in these verses, and again, it's easy to see how down Job is, and how miserable and worthless he thinks himself to be. Notice how contrary this is to God's viewpoint. What is Job in God's eyes? What had happened in the interview? Satan and God had said, Satan had said, if you take everything away, he'll curse you to his face. And God has said, I have a jewel down there. His name is Job, and he's going to make you eat dirt. Job was God's showcase. What was Job in his own eyes? Well, you read it in these verses. Verse 3, let the day perish on which I was to be born. He's God's showcase. And the night which said, a boy is conceived, may that day be darkness, let not God above care for it, nor light shine on it. Let darkness and gloom, black gloom, claim it. Let a cloud settle on it. Let the blackness of the day terrify it. So notice the emphasis is the disparity between how Job looks at himself and how God looks at him. Job is keying off of circumstances to view himself, and therefore you've got a powerful lesson in the disparity that can exist in our own self-image and the way God sees us. How does God see us? What is the doctrine, the category we talk about? We talk about positional truth, and it's the fact that, therefore, if any man be in Christ, he is what? A new creation. That's God's view of us. Do you ever feel like you're not a new creation? Ephesians 1, it says, we are accepted in the Beloved. What does that do for an inferiority complex? Anything? Do you ever feel I don't know a way to put it except, I hope it won't be offensive, but do you ever feel like you're a fire plug and all of your friends are dogs? That's the idea that is there. And positional truth from the standpoint of Scripture counteracts that sort of thing. And therefore, for the believer today, the parallel will be here is Job, who is dirt in his own eyes and who is in despair, and yet God is simply saying to Satan, there's my showpiece right down there. And there can very well be many, many days when you feel extremely low and you don't know, but what God is saying, hey, that's my showpiece down there, that's you. And therefore we should relate to what we are in Christ and realize our position, which is so important. Again, noting he cursed the day he was born, he did not curse God. All right, moving from that, the curse of that day to, number two, the curse of that night. Curses that day, and now he curses that night. And that's in verses 5 through 10, or 6 through 10. Now reading with verse 6, as for that night, let darkness seize it. Let it not rejoice among the days of the year. Can you imagine saying, of all the days of the year, there's one on which we mourn and which is the blackest of all days. And what is it? For me, October 13th is the day of the year on which all of the gloom and all of the despair ought to be celebrated. It's the day of mourning because October 13th is my birthday. Can you imagine having that view of life? Your birthday is the day of mourning. So verse 6, as for that night, let darkness seize it. Let it not rejoice among the days of the year. In other words, the day of my birthday is a black day. Let it not come into the number of the months. Behold, let that night be barren. Let no joyful shout enter it. Let those curse it who curse the day, who are prepared to arouse Leviathan. Let the stars of the twilight be darkened. Let it wait in light, but have none. Neither let it see the breaking dawn, because it did not shut the opening of my mother's womb or hide trouble from my eyes. So he is cursing the very night and cursing his very birthday. Now, question. Is Job, multiple choice, A, holding in his emotions, or B, letting them out? What's he doing? If you let your emotions out, you are not in control, right? No, that's not true. The same thing we had first hour. Notice that Job is obviously not holding in. He is letting out. Second question, does Job have no self-control? Did he curse God? No. Why? Because he was in control. Did he express emotion? Yes. Does he have any doctrine in his mind when he's expressing this emotion? Well, I would say he did in chapter 1, verse 21, and in chapter 2, verse 11. He has lots of doctrine in his mind. So notice there is a distinction between self-control and expressing of emotion. Job is not a cold stoic. As we said in the last hour, God is not testing Job to say, see, Satan, he's a piece of wood. He didn't even flinch. No tears, no suffering, no emotion. He's a log. And Job was not that. In fact, look over at chapter 6 and verse 12. He uses that metaphor. Job Job 6:12, he says, "Is my strength the strength of stones, or is my flesh bronze?" He says, "What do you think I am, a rock that has no emotion? Or am I a piece of bronze that has no expression to it?" Job had powerful expression. We might tie that, we'll not go to it, but if you want to see other powerful expressions of emotion and yet self-control, try Jeremiah 20, 14 through 18. And Jeremiah does the same thing. He laments the day he was born. Or look at Lamentations chapter 3. Or the crowning example, Matthew 27, 46, Christ on the cross, my God, why have you forsaken me?" Now, notice, however, there is one other thought, and we don't want to make Job a person here who not only has no emotion, but I don't mean to imply that throughout the book of Job, Job is always right. I personally think that Job expresses something in chapter 3, and I'm going to put it down now, that is wrong. It's a very common human philosophy, which says this: life is not worth living without happiness. Life is not worth living without happiness. Frankly, Job is saying that. I'd rather be dead than have all of the material possessions, all of the happiness of life taken away. Now, here's where I think we need to make a distinction, is that God nowhere has promised that life can be accompanied. This is a low view of life, is it not? Life is not worth living without happiness. Is happiness the ultimate in life? Contrary, life is for the glory of God. It's the purpose of life. Life is for God's glory. Job is going to glorify God, but Job didn't have a happy life. Let me read to you some other people that didn't have a happy life. And perhaps we ought to make a distinction here. What's the difference between happiness and joy? They're different, quite different. I think we can say basically, to be happy is dependent upon external things. And I have no problem with that. I'm happy when external things go well. And external things that are nice make me happy. Sometimes it gets put, happiness is what you have when happenings happen happily. Okay? Joy does not depend on that. Joy does not depend on external. Joy is independent of external things. And we could substantiate that many, many places. Can a Christian live a life and have great inner joy, irrespective of circumstances? Yes. Do we have a guarantee that life is going to make you happy? No. Look over at Hebrews chapter 11. I'll show you a bunch of people that certainly didn't have a happy life. Chapter 11. Verse 35. Very interesting concept here. How some of these believers experienced enormously happy things in life. Others experienced enormously unhappy things in life. Notice verse 35. Does this describe happiness? Women receive back their dead by the resurrection. That happy? I think this believing woman is happy when her husband, who has been dead for several years, is resurrected? Boy, that's happiness. Others were tortured. What's the difference? Why? 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 You answer that? Anyone smart enough? I don't have one. Why? Some received their dead by the resurrection. Others were tortured. Why? What's the difference? First part were spiritual, the second part were carnal? No. They're all listed in what list? Heroes of the faith. And yet how different are their circumstances of life, and why the difference? We don't know why the difference is, except we know this. Was there a benevolent purpose of God in each? Yes. Did they see it? No. How would you like to have been one of those that were tortured? And can you see the temptation to look at that? My fellow believer over here just received back her dead husband from the dead, and I got tortured last night, and I'm being tortured, and I will be tortured. Why? 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 God isn't fair, right? And that would be the human way of thinking, but that's not the case. They're all heroes of faith. Others were tortured. See, the only way you can
reconcile this is simply to say that God is wise beyond our intelligence. He is wise beyond what we can understand. Why the two classes, I do not know. Women received back their dead by resurrection. Others were tortured, not accepting their release in order that they might obtain a better resurrection. Others experienced mockings. Boy, that makes you happy. And scourgings, and that's happiness. Yes, also chains and imprisonment. They were stoned. And we can't, I guess, say it's not happy to get stoned in our modern context, but stoned with rocks here. They were sawn in two. That is a delight. They were tempted. They were put to death with the sword. They went about in sheepskins. This describes their life now. In goatskins, being destitute. Is that happiness? Afflicted, ill-treated. Men of whom the world was not worthy, wandering in deserts and mountains and caves and holes in the ground. All these, get it? Whether they had happy things happen in life or had unhappy things that happen in life, all these, having gained approval through their faith, did not receive what was promised because God had provided them something better for us, so that they, apart from us, they should not be made perfect. So, going back to Job. Now, looking at one other angle here, and I'll use this to complete down through verse 10. What is harder to bear than unexplained, apparently unfair trouble? And that is what Job is dealing with. All right, time enough just to get into the second part. First of all, Job curses the conception and birth. And now, second, Job longs for death. Or why didn't I die at birth? Job longs for death. Beginning at verse 11, he says, why did I not die at birth? Come forth from the womb and expire. Now, at this point, we need to make a distinction. Job desires to die for entirely different reasons than what you have in the New Testament. And I think we'll pick up at this point tonight. In the New Testament, Paul says, to be absent from the body is to be present with the Lord. And therefore, he anticipated death because it was promotion into the presence of God. Job was entirely different. Job doesn't want to die so he'll be with the Lord. Why does Job want to die? Job wants to die so I can get out of the suffering. And notice the way, looking down at verse 11, verse 13. He says, if I had died, then now I would have lain down and been quiet. Why does he want to die? To get out of suffering. I would have slept then. I would have been at rest. Why does he want to die? To get out of the sufferings of life. Verse 16. Why couldn't I be like a miscarriage which is discarded? I would not be as infants that never saw light. I want to be out of the sufferings of life. Verse 18. It says, the prisoners are at ease together. They do not hear the taskmaster. In other words, they're free of the vicissitudes of life. The small and the great are there. The slave is free from his master. Why do I want to die? To get out of this suffering of life. And again, that is in sharp contrast, which we'll pick up with this evening, to the New Testament teaching, which advances much, much beyond this particular point. Father, we're thankful today for your word. And we pray that we'll learn to identify with the suffering of Job and recognize the emotion of it all, and recognize at the same time there's to be self-control. And we pray that we will come to reality about suffering and not simply cite a lot of pious platitudes as his friends will, but we'll come down to the reality that you have benevolent purpose in all that you do toward us, your children, for we ask this in Christ's name.